This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. When he began reading about one of the most influential coaches ever to have presided on the gridiron, Paul Putz was pursuing his PhD thesis, which had to do with, as he puts it, the blending of sports and Christianity. He did a lot of his research in the library at the University of Chicago, where Amos Alonzo Stagg had coached football from 1892 until 1932.
You're sitting in a quiet room. It's often a very cold room. You're sitting in a hard wooden bench from 9 a.m. as soon as the library opens until close. Day after day, you're just looking through old documents, but you have to look through every single last one of the documents because you might miss something.
And there was a lot to look through because Coach Stagg lived for a very long time.
So he's born when Abraham Lincoln is president, before the Emancipation Proclamation. He lives to see the Civil Rights Act legislation pass.
When Amos Alonzo Stagg began his 40-year tenure as the football coach at the University of Chicago, he was introducing to the Midwest a game that had been pretty much entirely the property of the East, and a particular slice of the East at that.
It's an Anglo-Saxon elite game that was intended for the Ivy League colleges at Princeton and Yale and Harvard. And those schools start playing football because they want to strengthen Anglo-Saxon manhood and make sure that the men who come out of those schools who are going to lead the nation, make sure that they have these traits of physical masculinity and bravery.
Paul Putz found that Coach Stagg bought into that conviction that football was for white future leaders.
In the 1920s, an African-American newspaper reporter asks Stagg about his views on black athletes playing football. And Stagg, he talks about how there are successful black athletes in track and so on, but he says they lack the courage and bravery to play football.
Paul Putz wasn't surprised. Well, before he'd started poring over papers at the University of Chicago, he knew that so-called muscular Christianity was comfortable with the exclusion of blacks from lots of endeavors. Stagg was a man of his times, and those times had begun before Lincoln freed the slaves. But the telegram Paul Putz found next in the archives did surprise him.
I opened the folder that contains his correspondence with Henry Stimson, and I immediately perked up because I knew, oh, this is a famous figure.
Henry Stimson served as Secretary of War under Presidents William Howard Taft, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Harry Truman.
There's this telegram that Stagg had fired off to Stimson, and it says explicitly, since you were responsible for sending Japanese Americans to internment camps in the first place, will you send a message of support for returning Japanese Americans to Stockton? And when I saw that telegram, it did surprise me. It definitely sparked a real interest in figuring out that story.
That story began more than 100 years ago when Coach Stagg did something that in one respect was genuinely progressive, even revolutionary. He took his University of Chicago baseball team to Japan.
And this is sort of an unprecedented activity to take a college team, go on a tour that's going to take up almost a quarter of the school year. But Stagg does this in 1910, takes a trip to Japan. He does it again in 1915 and in 1920 and 1925. And so there's four trips to Japan that Stagg takes. Ultimately, it leads Stagg to develop some friendships and relationships with the Japanese citizens that he meets.
One of those citizens was an aspiring coach named Haito Okabe, who later visited Stagg in Chicago. The two men developed a friendship that would last for half a century, enduring the interruption of the Second World War. Much of their correspondence was conducted by letters like this one, which Stagg sent in May of 1930.
Last year's class brought in many boys who are athletically inclined, more than for several years past. I hope that I will not pass on until we have recovered most of the prestige in athletics which the University of Chicago once had.
Coach Stagg would not pass on for more than three decades, but as it happened, 2 years after he wrote that letter, Stagg left the University of Chicago. And it wasn't his idea. He was 70. His superiors felt he was too old. College of the Pacific in Stockton, California disagreed. Stagg coached there until 1946, meaning, of course, that he was in California when President Roosevelt decided that Americans of Japanese descent represented a potential danger to the U.S. and established internment camps. One of the enthusiastic architects of that policy was Henry Stimson, Roosevelt's Secretary of War. He'd also been Coach Stagg's classmate and good friend at Yale, and the two had continued to correspond, all of which might not have mattered particularly to PhD candidate Paul Putz if his laborious search through Stagg's papers at the University of Chicago hadn't turned up that telegram Stagg had sent to Stimson in April of 1945, shortly after the president suspended the internment order.
On April 15th, I'm presiding at a large meeting for discussion of the resettlement of Japanese Americans of this community. Since the War Department was responsible for their withdrawal from California, I would deeply appreciate you telegraphing me a brief statement endorsing our endeavors for fair play for those returning.
Ultimately, Stimson decides not to send a personal letter of support, so Stimson instead he sends along a canned statement from the War Department. It just talks about fair play for Japanese Americans and that sort of thing.
I know you will understand how sorry I am to disappoint you. Warmest personal regards, Henry L. Stimson, Secretary of War.
If he was disappointed, Coach Stagg didn't leave any written evidence of it. He took what he could get and ran with it. Or, more precisely, he used it in a community meeting that he attended. And in his next communication with Secretary Stimson, Stagg is clear about the purpose of the meeting and its result.
He tells Stimson about how the meeting went, and before the meeting, he refreshed himself on the Constitution.
After refreshing myself on the Constitution, at the end of the meeting, I introduced the following resolution, which was unanimously approved. Whereas, by the Constitution of the United States, all citizens of the United States are guaranteed the rights of life, liberty, and property. We citizens of this community.
Stagg calls for the citizens of Stockton
to ensure the returning Japanese Americans their rightful privileges as citizens.
Coach Stagg would find other allies in his quest, including one fellow who had amassed considerable authority since he had been Stagg's student and a competitive race walker at the University of Chicago. When the local chapter of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in Stockton made it clear that Japanese Americans would not be welcome when they returned to the community, Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes sent a telegram supporting his fellow citizens, all of them.
And when Stagg sees Ickes's telegram, he brings that telegram to one of these, the meetings of his citizens group. He reads it to the group. He uses this to sort of give them encouragement and to let them know, hey, even if locally in Stockton we're getting opposition, we have the support of Harold Ickes. We have the support of others who defend the cause that we're supporting.
After Stagg's successful meeting, he got in touch with his old friend to tell him about his efforts in Stockton. Ickes, who had opposed the establishment of the internment camps, was delighted.
I have always felt that all the people needed was the right kind of leadership, and you can furnish that in your community.
It's interesting to note that by the time Stagg was calling these meetings, waving around those telegrams and letters from members of the administration, and leading the campaign to accept into his community citizens who'd been deprived of their liberty and stripped of their property, Stagg was 82 years old. He'd found a cause that transcended athletics, and he'd embraced it with all the energy of a linebacker tying up the man with a ball. And for Stagg, it was personal, as Paul Putz discovered when he began reading about another of Stagg's former players.
Lou Sunikawa plays football for Stagg from 1936 to 1938, then goes off and fights in World War II. He's actually wounded in France in 1944, and so Sunikawa is sent back to the United States in 1945. And one of the first things that Sunikawa does when he returns to the United States is he sends Stagg, his old coach, a postcard. Stagg writes back a letter.
Dear Sune, you speak of convalescing at Fort Lewis. I hope that does not mean that you are still suffering from your wounds.
And it's really a tragic letter to read because here's this Japanese-American soldier who was wounded fighting for the United States and France. And Stagg has to write to him as he's sitting in a hospital and has to tell him that you probably shouldn't come back to Stockton right now because right now I'm organizing this campaign to try to defend Japanese American citizens, and if you came back, you probably wouldn't be welcome.
I certainly hope you make a good recovery. Mrs. Stagg joins me in warm regards and many good wishes.
2 years later, in 1947, Stagg was able to resume his correspondence with his fellow coach, the Japanese visitor whom Stagg had tutored in the arts of football when Stagg was coaching in Chicago. Haito Okabe's news from Japan was hard for Stagg to hear.
My only son went to die in the defensive air battle at April 12, 1945. Now my family are only three. My wife is 50 years old, daughter is 21, and myself 67 this September. Our daily life, sad, hard, miserable. Only hope of people's is in reliance of the good policy of the USA.
You know, I originally thought that these letters that I found as I was doing my research, that I would hold on to them and I would wait for the dissertation. But as I was watching the election take place and the rhetoric, and then as I saw athletes like Colin Kaepernick starting to speak out against racism in sports and using their platform in that way, and as I saw the reaction against athletes like Kaepernick doing that, it really seemed to me that this speaks to the moment that we're in right now.
These days, Colin Kaepernick's gesture feels like old news, as do the similar gestures of various other football players, as well as basketball players and soccer players. The protests are bigger now and noisier, and they're not limited to playing fields. They're in the airports. They're in the streets. But the story of Amos Alonzo Stagg's energetic defense of the rights of Japanese Americans 72 years ago provides another reminder, perhaps a more hopeful reminder, of a particular truth. This man who, in the 1920s, confidently said that black athletes lacked the courage and bravery to play football, couldn't have known many black athletes at the time. He did come to know, and know well, various Japanese and Japanese Americans, and getting to know them convinced him that, at a time when his conviction was attacked and ridiculed, they were precisely as entitled as anybody else to be treated by everybody else as equals. In 1939, an all-Mexican-American team faced an all-white opponent in the San Antonio High School Basketball Championship.
They weren't supposed to be able to do that. You know, there was this perception that the Mexicans could not play at that level.
What happened next? That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I never read the sports page and only vaguely follow sports in general, writes listener Susie Two. You have made me a sports convert, but only for your show. Many thanks to Susie Two for that review on iTunes. Consider leaving a review of your own on your favorite podcast app. It helps other listeners to find our show. For this week's three stories you should know, we're going to begin with something serious and move along to something that probably shouldn't be taken so very seriously. My companions in that adventure are Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Eric Malinowski of Bleacher Report. They both join me via Skype. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Always good to be back.
Patrick, you have laid claim to the more serious story, so you're on.
So my story is about Colorado State men's basketball coach Larry Ustashi. And it turns out during the 2013-14 season, he was investigated by his school. The investigation shelf, it documents Ustashi punching and breaking locker room whiteboards, throwing unopened soda cans against walls. One person who works with mental health with the basketball players at Colorado State, he said Ustashi was a, quote, rageaholic. And he said if you dropped a camera inside their program, you would have Rutgers. Now, we all know what happened to Mike Rice, the rageaholic coach there. Rutgers fired him. Colorado State investigators recommended that the school do the same thing with Ustashi, but the school did not do that. It put him on a personal improvement plan, and it did this even though it also told the coach that he was no longer allowed to be alone with his players. Think about this. That is crazy. Now, I am all for employers giving troubled employees support. That's good. That's compassionate. But I don't think you can do that when those same employees are hurting everyone else at the office. And I think the fact that Colorado State went this way speaks to this sort of weird ongoing deference that we pay to sports in our society. You know, we act like it's somehow different than in our workplace. I mean, imagine if Ustashi was like an English professor or something and he was running his writing workshops by throwing books at the walls and punching holes in whiteboards. He'd be let go, and rightfully so.
Patrick, I have to ask, did you have some sort of a listening device or camera in the classroom when I was teaching English?
I did not. And I taught journalism. I mean, hopefully people were staying awake. That was my main concern.
Eric, what do you think about this?
in a vacuum, like, I feel like this is the kind of thing that could potentially just really be applauded. Like, oh, like, they actually tried to help. Like, it was clear this guy had some problems and they tried to help him. But the things that this guy, you know, has admitted to and is accused of doing are just so heinous. Like, I can't even believe that this guy is still gainfully employed.
I think there should be zero tolerance for this sort of behavior. When a coach is hired, he should be told that he's expected to comport himself as a responsible adult. And now I will return to my fluffy cloud from which I'll observe the Paisley birds delivering candy canes to all the lovely children. It isn't like that in college sports. If you win, you keep your job.
Right.
I still think a lot of people think, oh, that's what a coach is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you really make guys tough. And to me, there's just a real soft bigotry of low expectations involved with this. It's like, we should expect more from these coaches, especially when they're making millions of dollars a year. It's not too much. So when you feel a little bit of a rage-a-hall fit coming on, take a timeout, count to five. Anyone can do that.
That's
it
perfect.
Works for my three-year-old.
All right. My topic is the New York Knicks, so I'm sorry. Forbes has apparently determined that the Knicks are the most valuable franchise in the NBA, even though they're more than a dozen games under 500. This is, of course, partly because they're in New York. The team makes a lot of money from cable TV and various other sources that have nothing to do with their one lost record. Maybe this is a rhetorical question, but have we in fact reached the point where winning games just doesn't matter very much? And does that make obsolete the old theory that the best way for owners to attract more fan interest and make more money is by winning? Eric, what do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, we should really dispel this myth that, like, a team's popularity in large part is based on sort of how successful they are. I think the one sort of exception to all this kind of is the Golden State Warriors, who, you know, have been wildly successful these last 3 years. Even when they were bought in 7 years ago for $450, they were only valued at $350. And now they're valued at $2.6 billion. And guess what? The Warriors might be really bad in 5 or 6 years. They're still going to be worth $2.6 billion. I mean, such it is with team valuations. They're often arbitrary and unexpected.
Because of the just enormous amounts of TV money, because of the revenue sharing, because of getting the public to buy the stadiums, because of having these sort of quasi-monopolies, you know, for all these reasons, you could be James Dolan, and the Knicks can never be good. And you're going to make money hand over fist no matter what. Hmm. And let's not forget, with Knicks fans, despite them losing, and losing some more, every single year, they seem to think they're going to win the championship.
All right, Eric, we've saved your story for last because it might involve a former wrestler and perhaps even some cartoon characters. What do you got for us?
That is quite a tease. Basically, the premise is, what do you get when you cross the world's most popular athlete with a bankable movie star with a mega Hollywood producer? And the answer is, hopefully, LeBron James. This is the premise of a really interesting ESPN The Magazine story, came out this week, written by Pablo Torre. LeBron is in his 14th season in the NBA. The Cavs are the defending champions. He is playing some of his most excellent basketball of his career, but, you know, he wants to be the Rock. You know, he wants to be starring in these movies. He wants to be producing. He wants his impact on the world to be great and to reach out in all these different directions. And I say, bring it on. I welcome my impending LeBron James overlord. You know, we think about, you know, what Michael Jordan has been sort of post his career. I think that, you know, that it is limitless for LeBron James, and I'm all for it.
I'm going to be thinking about the phrase impact on the world for some time now, but some former basketball players managed to actually have an impact on the world. Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, people like that. But okay, if LeBron wants to make movies like Michael Jordan did and sort of shadowbox with Bugs Bunny or something, I, you know, what the heck? Maybe I'll have grandchildren one day and they'll go see it. It'll be fine, I guess.
I'm just hoping that, you know, there's a peaceful transition of power from the Rock administration to the LeBron James administration 10 or 15 years down the road. I think what's interesting about LeBron is you see him sort of trying to leverage his celebrity into areas where his celebrity can make him even more money and sort of get him even more influence. That's kind of the coin of the realm now in America. You know, looking at the White House, celebrity really, really matters. I think Kobe is trying to basically do the same thing. So I'm also looking forward to 10 years from now, like, really tedious, like, barstool arguments about who has the better entertainment company, Kobe or LeBron.
Are we going to get movies like, you know, an old Sylvester Stallone against an old Robert De Niro, except it's going to be LeBron versus Kobe? Like, that would be all worth it, in my opinion.
Now I'm picturing Heat 2 with LeBron and Kobe in the diner.
My guests this week have been Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Eric Malinowski of Bleacher Report. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Earlier in the show, we heard how back in the 1920s, blacks weren't considered well-suited for the sport of football. Our next story is about another group of people, a couple of decades later, who were told they weren't meant to play basketball. They didn't listen. Here's reporter Noam Hassenfeld.
1939. The two best high school basketball teams in San Antonio are squaring off in the city championship. On one side, the home court Eagles from Brackenridge, an all-white team with fans packing the stands. On the other side, the Vokes from Lanier High School, an all-Mexican-American team from San Antonio's west side.
The newspaper people really played it up. This is the perfect matchup.
That's Professor Ignacio Garcia, a former Lanier student.
Two teams that have played each other twice, and they both scored the same amount of points with each other. They've gone to the other person's home and they've won. What more sort of dream game can you have than this?
It's a striking image. Tall, lanky white kids playing against a team of mostly short, skinny Mexican-American players led by their star, Tony Cardona, all 5'1" of him.
He was so tiny, and he was so fast, and he was undoubtedly the best player in the city.
It's a hard-fought physical game, and despite the Eagles' height advantage, the Vokes respond with a constant barrage of quick passes. The strategy works as the Vokes keep the game close, and in the final minute, the ball finds little-used backup Alonzo Rodriguez, who somehow ties it up. The clock hits zero with the score 24-24. The game will go to overtime. The events of that night would shock a lot of people, and I'm not just talking about the outcome of the game. In a lot of ways, it comes down to history. Lanier wasn't just a Mexican-American high school. It was also one of the first vocational schools in an urban center in the country. That's actually where they got their name, Vokes, short for vocational. And being a vocational school meant that students were taught one of seven trades, including auto painting and sheet metal welding. The idea was,
these kids can't go to college, but they're really good with their hands.
Teaching students trades was a way to get them jobs, not a way to prepare them for better-paying white-collar work or leadership roles. But bringing Mexican-American students from Lanier into the workforce was part of a larger goal.
If you could assimilate them into the workforce, then you were assimilating them into American society.
And this wasn't exactly subtle. At Lanier, the messaging was explicit.
Every Monday, the school would issue you a ribbon that said, "I speak English, I'm an American."
Joe Bernal is a former Lanier student who played for the Vokes in 1944.
If they heard you speaking Spanish, they would go and say, "Come here." And they take your pin away from you to get your name and your homeroom teacher, and you got demerits.
In some ways, this was a reflection of the time period.
There was a perception in the 30s that you had to integrate and assimilate because there really was no Mexican-American future in the way we perceive it today.
And one of the best ways to speed up that integration? Basketball.
There was this notion that sports can make us good Americans.
During that 1939 championship game, Lanier was coached by William Herrera, or as most people knew him, Nemo. Nemo was born in 1900 to a Mexican-American mother and a Mexican father in Brownsville, Texas, a city in the Rio Grande Valley just north of Mexico. His family moved north to San Antonio shortly after he was born, and he went to Brackenridge High School. He was the first Mexican-American student to play sports at Brackenridge, and he was actually the first ever to graduate. And he saw up close what could happen if he didn't fit in.
By the time he's in his 20s, part of, you know, Operation Repatriation and other massive deportations had occurred. A lot of the Mexican-American families said, "Look, we've got to integrate. We've got to assimilate. We've got to not be seen as different because tomorrow, it could be us."
So Nemo bought into what Lanier and, to be fair, what much of the Mexican-American community at the time was preaching. Fully embrace American culture, speak English, don't stand out. And he channeled that message into basketball. Though he had a Spanish last name, he chose to pronounce it with an Anglo accent, Herrera. And even though both he and his players spoke Spanish fluently, he made sure to follow the example set by Lanier.
I never heard Nemo speak Spanish like we did. he wasn't letting up on the idea that we should all speak English in school.
He knew coaching a Mexican-American basketball team wouldn't be easy. Basketball might just be the quintessential American game. After all, unlike baseball and football, which evolved from English sports, basketball is the only major American sport invented from scratch in the U.S. And most white Texans didn't take kindly to a team of Mexican-Americans playing basketball, and playing it well.
They weren't supposed to be able to do that. You know, there was this perception that the Mexicans could not play at that level.
People regularly said things like,
their kids know their X and O's as good as they know their frijoles and tortillas. They play defense like mosquitoes.
They called the Vokes
wetbacks, dirty Mexicans, greasers. That was common.
I don't think they ever felt like we were Americans yet.
Here's David Rodriguez, a former Lanier student who played on the Vokes from 1943 to 45. But no matter what the players thought, Nemo's response was always the same.
At the beginning of the year, he always set us down and told us, you know, we're going to play, we're going to win, and you're not going to listen to the crowd, and don't listen to the taunts, the remarks they make.
You know, anybody saying anything ugly to you, the way you show them is to outplay them.
Let's go back to where we started. The 1939 San Antonio championship game between the all-Mexican-American Lanier Vokes and the all-white Brackenridge Eagles. The Eagles and the Vokes had played to a hard-fought tie. They were heading to overtime.
Of course, overtime back in those days was whoever gets the ball and scores first wins the game. So you could win it with one shot within seconds.
The Brackenridge Eagles get the ball to start overtime and work their way to the hoop. They get close, but the shot misses, and the Vokes grab the rebound. Out of the corner of his eye, Billy Saldana sees Tony Cardona streaking down the sideline straight to the Eagles' basket. Billy heaves a high arcing pass across the court. Tony catches the ball in stride and puts the ball up, and it goes straight through the hoop. The Lanier Vokes are San Antonio High School champions. An all-Mexican-American starting five defeating an all-Anglo team in basketball. In 1939, this was huge. It might not seem like a big deal, but this was almost 10 years before Jackie Robinson broke the color line in Major League Baseball. At the time, even more than baseball, basketball was a white man's game. But before this could all sink in for Tony and for the rest of the Vokes,
someone from the stands came down and he hit Tony Cardona in the back of the head.
There were not too many Lanier fans there, and they were outnumbered, and the Brackenridge people more or less ganged up on him. You know, they were surrounded by Brackenridge fans. It was kind of scary.
And things got out of hand pretty quickly.
The players started pushing each other. The coaches came in quickly, but the fans had already joined. The fans just got into it on the court and the stands, and they took it outside. They grabbed rocks, started throwing at each other, at cars and the building itself. One young man got stabbed. Others got beaten.
As for Tony, who had become a hero only moments earlier,
the assistant coach grabbed him, dragged him out, and put him in his car and said, just lay down on the floor. And all he could hear was, let's get Tony, let's get Tony.
Tony stayed hidden, and eventually the police showed up.
It took 8 police cars and a number of policemen to not only break up the fight, but to allow the bus that was carrying both the Lanier team and Lanier fans to be able to get out of Brackenridge, and they got pelted with rocks.
Imagine how difficult seeing this riot must have been for Coach Nemo.
He must have looked out there and seen a fight, and it wasn't just, you know, one school against the other. It really broke down in racial lines, and I think that was extremely uncomfortable for Nemo because he was sort of outside of that conflict. He didn't bring it to the locker room. He didn't bring it to practice. He didn't bring it home. But now it had intruded in the most important moment at that time of his life.
For Nemo's whole life, he believed that if he just kept his head down and did things the right way, he'd be accepted by white Anglo-Texas. And he found out that wasn't true in the most dramatic way possible. But what's interesting is what happened next. He kept going. He didn't change. He didn't quit. He just went right back to the same message, telling his players to focus on the game, to not stand out. And Lanier kept right on winning. They became the best high school basketball team in the entire state of Texas, winning 2 state championships. But still, Texas never quite accepted them.
We felt like we didn't get the notoriety we deserved. the wins we had. When we won the state in 1943, there was no parties, no nothing.
In the end, Nemo must have understood that in Texas in the 1930s and 40s, he would never truly fit in. But he pushed, and America pushed back.
That's reporter Noam Hassenfeld. For more about the Lanier basketball team, check out Ignacio Garcia's book. It's called When Mexicans Could Play Ball. The first time she jumped off a building, Jessie Graff knew she'd found something special.
Oh, this is where you belong. You're falling through the air. And that's what feels like home to me.
How stunt double work led to an athletic first for women, just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of the creation of perhaps the most significant single piece of athletic equipment, at least for 50% of athletes. But right now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. And you know what? I can guess what that
is. I bet you can.
I'll wait till the show, but I can guess.
Texas legislators are apparently considering a so-called bathroom bill that would direct citizens to use only the bathroom appropriate to the gender identification on their birth certificates. The NFL, not always the world's most progressive corporation, has warned Texas legislators that the state might not be hosting Super Bowls in the future if this happens. How are the legislatures taking that?
Well, it's not so much the legislators as much as it is Governor Greg Abbott, who is saying that the NFL's walking on thin ice, wading into politics as though the NFL hasn't been involved in politics since its very founding. But, you know, this is the choice you make. This is the business you've chosen, Texas legislature. And if you want to do it, then call up your friends in North Carolina and see how well it worked out for them.
Yeah, North Carolina's Governor Roy Cooper wants that state's HB2 law to be repealed by the end of the month, or he fears that the NCAA is going to hit the state with a six-year NCAA tournament ban. Is that, in fact, likely to happen?
I think it might be. And, you know, once again, as we've said on this program several times, it takes a lot of work to put your state on the wrong side of a moral issue from the NCAA, but North Carolina insists on doing this.
President Trump has decided he will not fill out a 2017 NCAA tournament bracket for either the men's or the women's tournament, breaking a tradition that, the tradition only began with Barack Obama, but maybe Mr. Trump is afraid of getting something wrong. You know, his winning streak would be broken.
I will guarantee you that he will call a press conference on the Wednesday after the championship game and produce a bracket that's perfect that he filled out before the tournament.
I thought maybe he was waiting to pick a winner in the Masters.
That would be the one he would do, actually. He would run a Masters pool, probably out of the Situation Room.
The UConn women. Here's a surprise.
Oh, no, Bill. No, tell me, no. Did they win another game?
Their 100th in a row, Charlie, on Monday night. And by their standards, at least, it was a squeaker.
Yeah, I mean, they won by 11. And they were, by the way, they were playing the number six team in the country, South Carolina. What more can you say? I mean, South Carolina is 21-3. They're very good, but they're not good enough to beat the University of Connecticut. Because nobody's good enough to beat the University of Connecticut.
You know, you ask, what else can you say? Yeah. I have one other thing that I could say. UConn has decided to rip up Gino Auriemma's contract and write him another one, which is going to pay him $13 million over the next 5 years.
There's a penalty clause in it. He has to pay the school $5 million if he takes another coaching job. There's no way he's going to take another coaching job.
Why would he?
Yeah, I mean, this is crazy. But, he's going to be the coach at UConn 3 weeks after he's dead.
You know, it occurs to me that the only coaching job he could take that would put him in a better position vis-a-vis winning games would be with the Globetrotters.
Possibly, yes.
Possibly, exactly. Charlie, you have often expressed your respect for the San Antonio Spurs. This week, that team presented you with another reason to feel that way. By beating the Pacers on Monday night, the Spurs assured themselves of their 20th straight winning season. Only the Utah Jazz, who had 21 from 1984 to 2004, have more consecutive winning seasons. Pretty impressive.
It's an extraordinary combination of players, coaches, and front office people. The fact is that they have had a winning record every season since Tim Duncan was a rookie, and that was in 1997, and boy, does that make me feel old. It sort of is a consistency of excellence, but it's a consistency of more of giving your patrons what they want and keeping faith with your fan base and not going through you know, what the Los Angeles Lakers are going through right now and what other teams have gone through without ever getting to where the Spurs got to. If I were a Spurs season ticket holder, I would feel very, very justified in spending the money every year.
Mike Ilitch, who'd owned the Detroit Red Wings and the Detroit Tigers, died last Friday. He was 92. I knew he owned those teams, and I knew that he'd made a lot of money selling pizza. I hadn't known until this week that at one point he had paid the rent on Rosa Parks' apartment for more than a decade. Pretty good thing to be remembered
for. Yeah, that's
for.
And to not have it revealed until after you die, not to make a big deal of it when you're alive. I mean, that's the definition of charity, is to do it without people watching, and I think this is a remarkable story.
And finally, Charlie, we have a story from the European Youth Olympic Festival, where the president of the Turkish Ice Hockey Federation told the media that 87,000 children play ice hockey in Russia and 579 children play the sport in Turkey. Why do you suppose he felt publicizing those statistics was important?
Well, because, Bill, only 42 of those 87,000 children who play ice hockey in Russia scored against the Turkish youth team.
Who scored none?
Who scored none? Russia beat Turkey 42-0.
Oh.
They scored 15 in the first, 12 in the second, and 15 more in the third to add up to 42-0. But my favorite part of the story, the player of the game was the Russian goalie who pitched a shutout.
Doesn't say how many shots.
No, not at all. But I'll tell you, if your team's going to put up 42, you're very relaxed in goal.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In 1984, Joan Benoit won gold in the first ever women's Olympic marathon. In 2002, Lisa Leslie was the first to dunk in a WNBA game. And in 2008, Danica Patrick won an IndyCar race. She was the first woman to do that. This next story is about another first for women in sports, but it's really about something more significant than that. It's about becoming your own hero. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
When Jessie Graf was 12 years old, she wasn't set on becoming a pioneering athlete. She was set on becoming a superhero. More specifically, a warrior princess.
She was Xena, a mighty princess forged in the heat of battle.
She was just like this strong, heroic woman who rode around on a horse with a sword, and I wanted to be a hero like her. You know, I'd tape every episode and go back and watch them and just pick apart the form of what she was doing, how she would do these flying sidekicks. And so I would kick down all the dead trees in the woods near my house.
Jessie braided her hair and even cut her bangs to look like Xena. But looking like Xena wasn't enough.
I remember there was a bully who was like whacking his jacket at this girl who didn't have very many friends in school. And I was like this little 50-pound kid in sixth grade. I was a shrimp. And I just ran up and round kicked him in the stomach. And he was so confused. He stopped and he just looked at me and he was like, "Did you just kick me?" Like, he didn't even know. And I was like, "Yeah." And I just walked to class.
Jessie filled her mother in on her plan.
I told her, when I grow up, I'm going to be the next Xena. And she was a Broadway dancer and actress. And she was like, "Well, you know, maybe you could be your own hero." And I was like, no. When Lucy Lawless retires, they're going to need a new Xena, because obviously the world can't be without Xena. I'll just take her place. I'll be ready by then.
Young Jessie did all she could to prepare herself for a future as a warrior princess. She took circus classes, trained in flying trapeze, and competed in gymnastics. Then in high school, she picked up pole vaulting. She earned a scholarship to Nebraska and pursued a second dream, the Olympics. Jessie put the superhero plan on hold so she could focus on the pole vaulting. Soon, she was within 1.5 inches of qualifying for Olympic trials. But during her junior year of college, Jessie stopped improving. She wasn't vaulting any higher.
I needed a new motivation, and I saw this ad on TV. It was like E! Entertainment or something. And they're like, "Yeah, they want to make a new Wonder Woman movie, and they haven't decided who to cast yet. They're thinking maybe somebody unknown." And I was like, "I got to do it. I want to do it."
So the summer before her senior year, when Jessie was home in Maryland, she got a meeting with her mom's agent in Washington, D.C.
I took the train into the city and brought, like, a headshot and resume and all the stuff you're supposed to bring, and I handed it to her. And she looked over it, and she goes, "What is this? Do you even act? Why are you here? You know what? You should be a stunt woman. Here." And she just, like, shooed me out of the office as my head is spinning trying to understand what's happened, because I'd accidentally given her the resume that I made for the circus when I was in high school. I didn't realize it. And before I had a chance to explain, she's just telling me about stunts, and it all suddenly hit me. I was like, why didn't I think of this? Of course, a stunt woman. What could be more perfect?
Jessie started reading and researching all she could about life as a stunt double. She planned to move to LA after graduation, so she started studying maps of the city's neighborhoods. And even before finishing school, Jessie got her first opportunity. It was a big one. Most stunt doubles start out with relatively simple maneuvers, say pretending to trip and fall. But when Jessie was on spring break, a non-union project needed a woman to do a backwards fall off a 50-foot building. Jessie hadn't joined the union yet, so she was one of the few people eligible for the job. That, and she was willing to fall backwards off a 50-foot building. She got the gig. After some debate over which airbag to use, Jessie was on the building's roof in the dark of night, pretending to be chased by a ghost.
The moment my feet left the building and I was in the air, all the stress was gone, and it was like, oh, this is where you belong. You're falling through the air, and that's what feels like home to me. I wanted to do it again, but they were like, no, that was perfect. We're done. Moving on. So it went quickly.
Jessie was hooked. In 2007, she graduated, moved to L.A., and began looking for more work.
My first year in L.A., I auditioned for all the live stunt shows, and I was really excited about the Pirates Dinner Adventure one because there's singing and sword fights and trampolines and circus stuff, and it was like, it's everything I love. Only it turned out that the female character is actually a mute gypsy who gets kidnapped by pirates, so she doesn't get to do any fights. And it's just the damsel in distress the whole time. So I was a little disappointed.
Still, Jessie took the job. And in her free time, she learned one of the male pirate roles, though she never got to perform it. And soon she found better stunt work. By her fourth year in L.A., she was booked solid. Then in 2013, she ended up on a TV show that doesn't involve any acting.
This summer, glory awaits on American Ninja Warrior.
On American Ninja Warrior, contestants take on obstacle courses. They jump from trampolines to dangling ropes and try other challenges that seem like they were dreamed up by a 12-year-old hopped up on sugar with an unlimited construction budget. Men and women compete against each other on the same courses. Jessie heard about the show from one of her former roommates. She doubted she'd be very good at it, but she figured it'd be fun and possibly good publicity for her stunt career. Turns out, the skills Jessie Graff had honed to become a warrior princess made her a great ninja warrior.
Jessie's parents and other family members here to watch tonight.
In 2015, the seventh season of the show, Jessie was one of the few women to make the national finals in Las Vegas. There, finalists try to finish four stages of obstacles. Out of the hundreds of competitors in the show's history, only two have ever completed all four, and most fail on the very first.
And it all starts with stage one, eight obstacles built to test balance, agility, and speed.
When Jessie lined up for season seven, no woman in the history of the show had completed stage one. Jessie took her turn. She got off to a great start, passing the propeller bar, the silk slider, and the jumping spider.
And by reaching the warp wall, she's gone as far as any woman in history.
But she needs to get up the wall quickly.
The warped wall is one of the toughest obstacles. To get past it, you have to run up a nearly vertical ramp, grab hold of the top ledge, and pull yourself up. Think running up the side of an empty swimming pool, only the pool is 14 feet deep.
Jessie, come on, Jessie.
So close.
Man, it looks like she's gassed out. It looks like she doesn't have enough energy.
Just like when she tried to vault herself to the Olympics, Jessie Graff was a couple inches short. And for a seventh year, stage two of American Ninja Warrior began without a woman. The next year, Jessie Graff was one of 18 women in Las Vegas for the national finals. All the others failed on the first stage.
I was the last woman in the order. So before I went, like, all that information was in there, all of that pressure of, like, if you don't trip on something, you're going to make history and your life is going to change.
Once again, Jessie started out strong.
And she has a great pace going.
Come on, Jesse. Come on, Jesse. Right back curve.
Technique onto the rope. Perfect. But now the warp wall. She couldn't get up it last year. In fact, no.
She took her run at the wall, and
as I was running up the wall, I realized that I had killed too much momentum and I wasn't going to make it. And so I just, like, I was reaching up with my right hand, and I feel like I almost, like, shoved it out of its socket to get an extra inch.
Oh, yes! Oh, yes! Jesse Graf continues to deliver!
And as soon as my hand was over the top, I was like, oh, my gosh, I did it. I'm going to finish stage one. And then instantly came back to reality and was like, dude, you have two more obstacles. Do not get ahead of yourself. Focus.
Jesse managed the broken bridge and the flying squirrel. And then
she's going to make history. History. The first woman to complete stage one. Jesse Graf has done it.
When I finally hit the buzzer at the top, and I just sank to the floor because I was like, you're done. You're done. You don't have to think anymore. Like, I didn't even know what to do with myself. It was crazy.
Since her success on American Ninja Warrior, Jesse has stayed busy as a stunt double. Recently, she's been working on the TV show Supergirl. And she's also been getting plenty of messages on social media. Women write to say that she's inspired them to get stronger and healthier. And parents send her videos of their young daughters doing pull-ups or climbing obstacles. In many of those videos, the girls are dressed in the same Wonder Woman skirt that Jesse wore on an episode of American Ninja Warrior. Some have even done their hair in a high ponytail to look like Jesse.
I mean, I always wanted to play a hero, but I don't know that it ever really occurred to me that I could, like, just be a hero to people as myself. And that's really a dream come true. I mean, beyond the dreams that I had for myself. It's amazing.
When Jesse Graf returns for season 9 of American Ninja Warrior, she'd love to be the first woman to complete stage 2. But Jesse's fans have taught her something.
Seeing the impact it can have on women and children and just people has now given me that perspective that, like, it's more important to me that someone does it than that I get to be the one who does it.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and the Only a Game players, Alex Ashlock, Chris Ballman, Dan Mawsey, and John Perotti. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Subscribe to Only a Game on your favorite podcast app, and while you're there, consider leaving a review. It'll help other listeners find our show. Our final word this week comes from warrior princess / stuntwoman / athlete, Jesse Graf.
I don't go anywhere without my sword. I mean, you have to be prepared for anything.
I hate when we close the program with something so obvious we just didn't have anything else this week. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.